Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On August 17th, the Rim Fire near Yosemite was a 200-acre blaze. It's now over 161,000 acres, or the size of Chicago. 32% of the fire has been contained. At least 23 structures have been destroyed. Over 4,000 people are fighting the blaze, and more than $40 million has been spent. The fire continues to rage as the U.S. Forest Service faces ongoing budget cuts, which makes it difficult to fund fire departments across the country. Today's guest, Katie Valentine, reports that the Forest Service has nearly depleted its budget for fighting wildfires at the peak of the season, a development which has forced the agency to divert $600 million in funds from timber and other areas to continue fighting fires. Katie Valentine is a climate reporter with Think Progress. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Nice to have you. And speaking of budget cuts, the second round of cuts will be implemented in October. Now, these will come on top of the cuts that have already been made, which means that more programs will suffer or be terminated altogether. But despite this, we keep hearing that the economy is improving. So what explains the disconnect in the media? And what about the programs that aren't seeing any cuts at all? According to a recent piece in the Washington Times, private contractors are making a killing. Last year, 59 major publicly traded government contractors earned $36 billion in profits, nearly entirely from taxpayers. David K. Johnston writes about this in the Columbia Journalism Review, where he's a columnist. David is an award-winning journalist and author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, and it's just now out in paperback. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. And Al Jazeera America launched last week. Today's guest, Lawrence Pintek, writes about it in the Columbia Journalism Review. And he writes, there was no sign of bin Laden, no call for jihad, and no ranting about the evils of the American empire. Just a workmanlike recounting of the day's events, interspersed with testimonials from fresh, scrubbed young reporters, most recently employed by local TV stations, telling us how much they love America and apple pie. Lawrence Pintek is professor of communication and the founding dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University. His latest book is called The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks.
It's great to have you. Well, we're going to talk about Syria in just a couple of minutes because Secretary of State John Kerry is speaking about it right now. But before we do that, Al, on Friday, we always start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, David, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I didn't see it until this week, but it's from a bit ago. But, you know, there's this wonderful no-advertising newspaper, the San Francisco Public Press, sfpublicpress.org. And they have two pieces that they ran earlier in August by Lisa Weinzimmer and Anna Vignette about carbon trading and air pollution in California. They're solid. They're in-depth. They'll tell you about something you didn't understand in all likelihood and may not even after you read this, much as they've tried. But I think they're very informing pieces, and I think it would be very good for journalism in the Bay Area if more people would pay attention to the sfpublicpress.org.
We always have copies on our desks here at the station, David. I'm wondering, how did you find it in New York?
Well, a friend of mine drew it to my attention. And of course, many years ago, back in the 70s, I was the LA Times national correspondent in San Francisco and was born there. So I always paid attention to the city. And they ran an excerpt from my current book, an excerpt dealing with PG&E and how customers are being relentlessly ripped off by PG&E. And I've been reading all of their issues, and every single one of them has solid, in-depth reporting on issues that I find very informing.
Great. Well, we'll have to let them know that you gave them kudos, and we'll post those stories on our website. Thank you, David. Katie, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Yeah, and my story, sorry, is actually from last week as well, but I didn't see it until this week. It's from Elizabeth McGowan at Inside Climate News, and she did a story on the Exxon pipeline spill in Mayflower, Arkansas from this past March. And Inside Climate News has done a really good job of keeping up with this issue after a lot of other publications kind of abandoned it after the major news of it occurring was finished. But they've done a really good job of keeping on it and looking into the lasting effects in the spill on residents' health and on the environment.
You know, this hasn't really received much coverage. Can you just give us a quick overview of what's happening?
Yeah, so this article was about the trying to figure out how much oil had actually spilled, and it's actually a lot more complicated than it seems because the EPA wants to wait till the Pegasus pipeline is back online so that they can kind of simulate the flow that the oil was going at the time of the spill. But it turns out that the pipeline was, a lot of the ways it was built are kind of outdated, and it may never go back online, so it's kind of difficult to figure out how much oil actually spilled. Right now, the estimates are about 5,000 barrels, but it's important because the accurate number will play a role in how big a Clean Water Act fine that Exxon pays. So the report itself didn't have a whole lot of answers just because there's a lot that goes into it, but it was a really good piece of reporting.
And didn't Inside Climate News raise a fair amount of money to continue reporting on this spill?
It did, yeah. I think they partnered with a local paper in Arkansas. So they have people, local reporters in Arkansas, and then also Inside Climate News reporters that are reporting on this. So
yeah,
it's been really good.
It's been really good. And I just was looking at a story that they wrote about how citizens are confused about where to go for the respiratory infections. They've got asthma, wheezing, all kinds of medical issues. So thank you. I'm so glad you brought that up. And we'll put links to this story on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Lawrence, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I must say the thing that leaps out most was a piece on The Onion this week, which was a tongue-in-cheek CNN explaining why Miley Cyrus's VMA performance was their top story. And it all came down to driving clicks on the web, of course. But
that story, I have no idea what it's about, but it dominated my Facebook feed this week, and I didn't click on it, so I have no idea what's going on with her, but it was everywhere this week.
I'm not surprised. It was a tongue-in-cheek piece, ostensibly written by the managing editor at CNN.com, and I'll just read you a little excerpt. She says, and obviously it's not really her, it's The Onion. So you may ask, why was this morning's top story, a spot usually given to the most important foreign or domestic news of the day, headlined, Miley Cyrus did what? And accompanied by the subhead, twerks, stuns at VMA. It's a good question, and the answer is pretty simple. It was an attempt to get you to click on CNN.com so we could drive up our web traffic, which in turn would allow us to increase our advertising revenue.
Huh.
So, obviously, like so many things in the Onion, more than a dollop of reality behind the satire.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between The Onion and CNN. So let's dive in here and talk about what's happening with Syria, because Secretary of State John Kerry was just giving a press conference. And NBC's headline is U.S. prepared to strike Syria despite rebuke from Britain, White House officials say. The BBC has a great overview of how the U.K. media reported on the government deciding not to call for an action against Syria. Front page headline of the Times, Cameron humiliated as MPs veto Syria strike. The Independent called the result of the vote a, quote, huge surprise. The Guardian says the Tories have accused the Labour leader of giving succor to the Assad regime. Lawrence, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, things are changing pretty quickly, but what are your thoughts on the coverage?
Well, a couple of dozen years ago, we talked about the CNN effect, this idea, this theory that media drives policy. And it is now instantaneous, and we are seeing that emphatically in this story. Clearly, at the end of the day, we, the public anyway, don't actually see evidence that the regime did this. Did the regime probably do this? Absolutely. Is there a 5% possibility this was a Machiavellian, a horrible Machiavellian step by the opposition to bring the U.S. in? Sure. But the bottom line is that this has become inexorable as we march toward doing something in Syria, because we keep hearing in the media, what's Obama going to do? They crossed the red line. He has to do something. He's going to lose face. The Iranians are going to read this as weakness. So we've been driven down this road by the reality of 24/7 instantaneous media coverage, as we've seen American policy overall in the Middle East be completely torn asunder by the effect of media.
We just got an email from a listener who wanted to give kudos to the AP for a piece called AP Sources Intelligence on Weapons is No Slam Dunk. So they interviewed some intelligence officials who say that we really need to question who controls some of these chemical weapons in Syria.
Indeed. And we also have to question, what is the effect going to be if we sit offshore and lob some cruise missiles in? What real effect does that have? We've seen that happen in the past, and at the end of the day, not much. There was an excellent interview on NPR, I forget which show, the other night with Ryan Crocker, who was the most recent U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, was the ambassador in Iraq before that, in Syria before that. And Crocker was saying, what effect? We've been down this road. The reality is that a few cruise missiles don't do anything. Assad already obviously has cleared out his airfields, and nothing's going to get destroyed that's significant. And the whole issue of a no-fly zone is in itself an act of war. And unlike Libya, Syria has very, very sophisticated anti-aircraft batteries that were brought in after the Israelis decimated their Air Force in 82.
And David, what are your thoughts on this? How do you think the media should go about covering a moving story like this at a time when the Obama administration says for sure it was the Assad government, and now you've got the UK saying they're not going to be involved?
Well, this is a very troubling story in which the guy in power is awful, but the people who want to replace him may be just as awful and possibly worse. And I have to think about this the way I do all war things, and that is, am I willing to give up one of my grandsons? And I'm afraid not in this case. And I certainly hope that news coverage is not influencing the decisions being made by the U.S. in this matter. Presumably the president and the huge intelligence operation that we now know, thanks to Edward Snowden, is costing us over $1 billion a week. is providing us with pretty solid intelligence as to what's going on there. And it's awful what's going on there. I don't mean to diminish that. But let's remember the idea that if you're going to go into another country, you need to do it with the UN, you need to do it with a whole group of countries, you need to have a clear mission as to what you're doing, and you need to do it, as Colin Powell taught, with overwhelming force. If you're going to do that. Instead, we're talking about some sort of, relatively minor punishment on the Assad regime for evidently having used gas weapons. I would hope we would, step back and think more deeply about the degree to which we are entangling ourselves in matters that we don't deeply understand, and where the forces that are at work have been at odds with each other for centuries.
Well, the other angle is the role Congress plays, because Representative Barbara Lee from Oakland, who was the only politician to vote against bombing Afghanistan, came out a couple days ago and said, we need you to make phone calls to your Congress people to say, don't do this. And apparently there was a meeting yesterday, and a lot of politicians said, you really need to let us know what's happening. A lot of them said they feel like they're in the dark on this.
Yeah, this is, the president created a problem for himself by making the red line comment, but that doesn't mean he can't walk it back. I have not seen any case made, and I think it needs to be pretty overwhelming, for the U.S. government to be committing itself into this, particularly now that you've seen the British walk back from this very clearly. And I don't see any good outcome no matter what happens here. I mean, this is an awful situation. I don't mean in any way to minimize the awfulness of it, but is it really central to the interests of the United States to get ourselves more deeply involved in this?
That is David K. Johnston. He is a columnist with Columbia Journalism Review. His latest book, The Fine Print, is now out in paperback. Lawrence Pintack is professor of communication and the founding dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State University. And Katie Valentine is a climate reporter with Think Progress. And Lawrence, we were going to talk with you about the launch of Al Jazeera America. Did you have one more story you wanted to talk about before we do that?
Well, certainly. I mean, since we are talking about Jazeera, I think, you know, overall their coverage this past week has been memorable, given what we normally see on American television. But specifically, they have an evening magazine show called America Tonight, and they had a series this week, an ongoing series on Chicago, kind of Wither Chicago, that has looked at gang violence from the perspective of gang members. It's looked at urban renewal. It's really kind of dug into the underside of Chicago, and in keeping with the overall theme stated theme of this network, and that is kind of looking at America from outside the Beltway and the places that most media do not look at America. And so it was a very compelling series.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was really struck because they actually sat down with gang members, young men. Their faces were covered, but, you know, you really don't see that in the national news. They all talked about how their fathers had been killed before the age of five. I mean, they were able to really tell their personal stories. That really struck me, and I felt like they really brought in voices that you don't really see on the networks in this country.
And you know what I thought as I watched it? Why is this important? Why am I so struck that, as you were, that I'm seeing this? Mm-hmm. Because we should be seeing this all the time. How is it that we are not out there interviewing gang members on a regular basis, interviewing people whose children have been killed in gang violence? There are so many stories that Jazeera is doing, taking this, looking at the other side of America, not necessarily the negative side of America, but, you know, they have bureaus here in Seattle, they have bureaus in Nashville, et cetera, in places that we don't cover. And it really is a statement on the state of American television news that you and I are struck by the fact that someone's interviewing gang members.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. They also interviewed children about what it's like to go back to school with very few resources. Katie, have you had a chance to see Al Jazeera America?
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts?
So, well, I was really impressed with actually their climate coverage. Their first day, they did a segment that was 30 minutes on climate change, and Media Matters actually had a comparison of that segment compared to the climate coverage of CNN and Fox News primetime over the last year, and they found that it was the 30 minutes that Al Jazeera America spent on climate change was actually more than those networks had spent in the past year on their major primetime shows. So that was really refreshing. And they didn't, the hosts they brought, or the guests they brought on, they didn't try to provide, climate deniers as well as climate scientists. They were very focused on the science and on the politics. That's the one thing I think I've seen from Al Jazeera America.
And it looks like the environmental media is watching closely, because Climate Science Watch reports Al Jazeera America got off to a good start with climate change coverage. Green Prophet, Qatar's Al Jazeera America, puts U.S. climate coverage to shame. And then Grist.org asks, will Al Jazeera change the way networks cover climate? Is it simply because we don't see these stories, or is the quality of the reporting actually really good?
That's a good question. I think it's probably both. I mean, I know just watching Fox News or watching maybe CNN in primetime, you're not really going to see a ton of stories about climate change. Even if you're going to see stories about maybe climate change's effects, maybe wildfires that could be in part fueled by a changing climate, you might not see the mention of climate change in there. So it's I think it's both. But yeah, it's exciting. I think maybe it does have the potential to influence other networks to maybe provide more of this coverage.
And David, what are your thoughts? Because I've been reading all week that Al Jazeera America has the opportunity to change the media landscape. I mean, what does that mean exactly? And do you agree?
Well, I think that we are seeing a complete disruption in the 400-year-old model of news. Remember, news began 400 years ago as a means to bring buyers and sellers together by telling people information. And for the trading class, the manufacturing class, and the merchant classes in Europe, it was also a way to gain information to address and understand the predatory instincts of the aristocratic class, as well as the dangers and costs they faced in trading in distant places. The internet has destroyed that model. That's why you're seeing newspapers disappear and shrinking right in front of your eyes like crazy. Now, Al Jazeera, and I need to disclose that they have approached me about being a columnist for them. Al Jazeera is done superb news. I've seen their reports when they were on the available only over your computer. I found them to be generally excellent. I thought that their coverage this week was a little bit, as our other guest pointed out in his Columbia Journalism Review column, a little bit like the low blood pressure news hour or NPR kind of approach, but solid, rounded, thoughtful, highly professional. And that's, I think, a very good thing. But we're clearly going to see a big change. We're going to see a change in who owns big news organizations. And we're going into a whole new world, and I'm not sure where it's going to be, but they appear to be a serious player about serious information that deserves serious attention.
Well, they're taking this very seriously in Capitol Hill because DLA Piper registered to lobby for Al Jazeera America effective January 2nd, and they're paid $120,000 to lobby Capitol Hill. Former Representative Michael Castle, a Republican from Delaware, is one of the lobbyists. Lawrence, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, it's interesting because we found this story over at Roll Call, and they showed that Comcast spent about $5.4 million lobbying just in the second quarter of this year alone. Time Warner, $1.9 million. News Corp, $1.4 million. Clear Channel, $1.3 million. And now Al Jazeera America's jumping into the ring.
Well, Congress obviously controls the regulations around television, around cable television particularly, and Jazeera has been lobbying in the U.S. for quite some time at various levels because they've been battling to get into this market for so long. For those who don't know the background, Jazeera Arabic was founded back in 96. Jazeera English, which is a global English channel, was founded about a decade or so ago. But they've been trying to get it on the air in the U.S. and have been blocked at every turn, largely for political reasons and concern by the Time Warners and the Comcast of political pushback. The way they finally got on the air was to spend $500 million to buy Current TV, which was Al Gore's documentary, pseudo-documentary channel. It was a failing venture, and that gave them entree. But as they got the entree, Time Warner then immediately dropped Current TV, and just on the eve of the launch, AT&T's U-verse, their mobile system, dropped the channel as well. So they've got a lot to lobby about, and they've got a lot of political baggage, as I said in the Columbia Journalism Review piece. Yeah, they sound a bit or look a bit like NPR with pictures, but they carry a lot of political baggage because, of course, their strength and their weakness is the name Al Jazeera.
And that is Lawrence Pintack, professor of communication and founding dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State. David K. Johnston writes about a number of issues at Columbia Journalism Review, where he has a column. His new book, latest book, The Fine Print, is now out in paperback. Katie Valentine is a reporter with Think Progress. And it's our media roundtable. It's your call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
All of the stories that you recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and we invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable as well by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will rebroadcast a conversation we had with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Hedrick Smith, author of Who Stole the American Dream? He says the last four decades of corporate and political power have led to the dismantling of this dream. So what does this mean and where do we go from here? And then on Tuesday, we'll continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on the economic collapse of 2008. It's been 5 years. September 15th, 2008 is when it happened. So what did we learn, if anything? And we just got news that the banks are posting massive profits and giving out major bonuses once again. So that's our conversation on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we already have full lines, but we'll have one open in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to talk about Al Jazeera America, if you've seen it, unfortunately, you can no longer watch it online, not even the news clips. So you have to have cable in order to watch Al Jazeera America. If you've seen it, we'd love to hear from you. What did you think? And we're going to talk about budget cuts in just a couple of minutes. Lots of things to discuss. And if you saw a story that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Katie Valentine is a climate reporter with Think Progress. David K. Johnston is a columnist with Columbia Journalism Review, author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, now out in paperback. And Lawrence Pintack is founding dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State. His latest book is The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil. And let's hear from Harry in San Francisco about Al Jazeera America. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I don't have a TV, so I can't watch Al Jazeera America, but several years ago when the Egypt uprising began, I discovered it online, and there's a lot of great programs, including 101 East, for example, which focuses on Asia, which I can no longer watch. I was just astonished to see that there was a total blackout, and you couldn't. This content is no longer available in your country, and it's not available on YouTube. And even after this stuff has been shown, it's not available. So I was wondering if your guest could give us the backstory about that, and if anybody from Al Jazeera is listening, can you do a little compromise where programs that aren't available in the United States are shown, and where we can at least watch some of those documentaries and so forth that were formerly streamed but we can no longer see, because it's cutting off a huge audience that is interested but isn't able to access cable TV.
Yeah, thank you. Or at least put up the videos after they air. Thank you, Harry. Lawrence, do you know the backstory behind this?
Yeah, there's nothing insidious there. It's simply part of the deal with their cable distributors and satellite distributors here in the U.S. that the content won't be available simultaneously on the web, and particularly Al Jazeera English, because it would be competing with Al Jazeera America. And just to be clear, these are all owned ultimately by the government of Qatar. They're all part of the Al Jazeera networks. But each of these individual stations or channels operates independently. In the same breath, if that viewer or others go to america.aljazeera.com, many, not the full programs, but many of the segments from the various programs on Jazeera America are there to be streamed online.
And I'm wondering just quickly what you think about some of the well-known faces they've hired, a lot of former CNN anchors. Do you think that this will influence the content, or do you think they might have free rein to go a little deeper?
Oh, I think they have free rein. I think those from CNN that are over there saw the opportunity to move into an environment where they have a little bit more free rein. You know, it's interesting. I just coincidentally was trading emails a moment ago with John Siegenthaler, who's their evening anchor. And John and their vice president for news gathering, Marcy McGinnis, people like that are senior refugees, as it were, as I am, from network television. John left a number of years ago. He had been an NBC anchor Marcy was a vice president at CBS. John set up a PR company. Marcy went into academia. And now they've come back because they see this opportunity for a very different landscape from the existing networks. And then the rest of the staff are either refugees from the networks, or many of the field people are longtime local journalists. The reporter here in Seattle, for example, was with the Seattle, one of the Seattle affiliates for 20 years. So they really know their market, but they see a new opportunity to do a different kind of reporting.
All right. Well, thank you, Harry. And we'll be sure to get on an Al Jazeera America reporter in the coming weeks. Let's go next to Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad.
Thank you for having me. I have a question which has been puzzling me well beyond the conflicts that we see today. We established, was it not the UN established for the purpose of quelling these types of conflicts that get out of control and going in and interceding so that there would be some sort of peaceable basis in which that individual nation could form the government which they chose within their territory? This isn't even being discussed. We're discussing issues that do they use one type of weapon versus another? What's the personal interest for us in this nation to that nation economically? Why is there no one who's raising that key question? The bottom line is that military conflicts being used to settle the dispute of what type of government body that independent nation wants is not going to be tolerated.
All right. Well, thank you for calling. Lawrence, do you want to take that?
Sure. I don't think no one's talking about the UN. Certainly, there's a lot of discussion about the UN. The reality is that the UN doesn't go in and certainly do things that are punitive or even go in and actually create peace. They go in as peacekeepers after a conflict has ended. So you see longtime UN peacekeepers sitting on the Golan Heights, sitting in Sinai, etc., to keep the peace rather than to create the peace. And the other problem is that, of course, the UN is all about big politics. And right now, and I'm not, you know, defending what the administration is about to do, but right now the reality is that because of the difference in big power politics between the U.S. and Russia and China over this issue, nothing is ever going to get done in the UN around the Syria situation.
All right. Thank you, Brad. And Lawrence, before we let you go, what questions should reporters and editors be asking right now in the coming hours, especially as the U.S. makes its case for attacking Syria?
What's the exit strategy? You know, clearly the old cliche, if you break it, you own it, is very true. And what next? If we lob some cruise missiles in, it will have essentially no effect. We will have made our point, but it doesn't change anything. So what do we do the next time there's a massacre? Where are we going? What is the broad strategy for Syria?
All right. Well, Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Lawrence Pintak, professor of communication and founding dean of the Edward R. Murrow College of Communication at Washington State. His latest book is The New Arab Journalist, Mission and Identity in a Time of Turmoil. And it's our media roundtable. And joining us for the rest of the hour is David K. Johnston. He's a columnist with the Columbia Journalism Review, an award-winning journalist. And his latest book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, is now out in paperback. He's been writing about budget cuts and why we don't see more stories about contractors and the wild profits that they're getting. And Katie Valentine is a climate reporter with Think Progress, and she's been closely following the rim fire and budget cuts to the U.S. Forest Service. So let's talk about that, Katie. Earlier this week, there was a letter. President Obama and Congress stopped the budget cuts to wildland firefighters, and it was signed by a number of firefighters. And I noticed at the local level, there were a lot of stories about how fire departments have been hit with budget cuts. In Portland, for example, they don't even have enough water to fight fires. But now in the last 2 days, I'm seeing this also hit the mainstream, the national media. Have you also seen those changes?
Yeah. Well, I think that with the RIM fire, it's kind of been bigger in the media because it's threatening Yosemite and because Yosemite is something that Americans know about, and probably many of them have probably been there. So with the RIM fire, I think that maybe larger news outlets are covering that, but then they're also looking into more of the local impacts that this fire and like this sequestration is having on more local municipalities and their firefighting capability. So I think that maybe this large fire that's very recognizable has helped kind of set the stage for smaller stories about smaller impacts.
And so tell us what you found in terms of how the U.S. Forest Service is being hit with budget cuts, and how does that affect the RIM fire specifically?
Yeah, so the U.S. Forest Service's budget was cut by $115 million by the sequester, and that would just be across-the-board cuts that affected all government agencies. And then also the FLAME Act, which was supposed to be, it was a reserve fund for wildfires, for fighting wildfires that was developed in 2009. It originally had $413 million in it in 2010, but it was cut to $299 million from sequester. So that that was a fund that was supposed to kind of make sure that the U.S. Forest Service didn't have to divert funds and it didn't run out of money for fighting wildfires. But it, since it's been cut and since wildfires has just become more expensive to fight and just have become a lot stronger and more frequent, then it's not doing its job as well as it should have. So, yeah, it's definitely making a difference. And I read a report recently that said that sequestration in the U.S. Forest Service amounts to 500 fewer firefighters and then 50 to 70 fewer fire engines. So it definitely is making real impacts.
And it seems like, David, this is a good time to really look at what the Forest Service actually does, because I don't think many people know how things are funded when you look at, you know, the local level, the national level, like a national park, for example. Who fights that fire? Who's in charge of that? Have you seen much reporting on the Forest Service and just the critical role that it plays in a situation like this?
Well, there's been a fair amount in the last few days because the Forest Service has been out informing journalists about this. But what you are seeing here is two factors. One is wildfires are a natural part of the western U.S. They are going to occur, and to the extent that we retard them through other policies, when we do have them, they're going to be the ferocious fires that you've seen in the last few years. But they are part of the natural cycle in the West. The second thing, however, is that this is what happens when you say we have to cut taxes because the rich don't have enough. And as I've reported extensively, as you know, what we have developed in this country over the last 30 years is a system of upward redistribution to the very highest income people. And the unstated but de facto policy of our government is that our major economic problem is the rich do not have nearly enough. And the way to get it for them is to take from programs that benefit the vast majority of people, as well as the sick, the disabled, children, and the elderly. We are not putting in an adequate amount of money into our infrastructure. We're not putting into things like national fire protection. And this is the result you're going to see from this, these inadequate budgets. And next year, what are we going to do? We have another big fire, as we almost certainly will, if not next year, the year after, as we continue this idea that somehow government is too big without qualitatively thinking about, well, what should government be doing?
So who's really making these connections? I mean, are you seeing this? I mean, the East Bay Express.
No. I mean, I was asked by one of my eight children one day, you know, why do you keep doing this? Because people aren't paying attention. And I said, I understand that. I feel like there's a tsunami coming and I'm holding my palm up. It's very troubling. And it's because most news coverage is reactive. It consists of people accurately quoting what they've been told, even if their articles demonstrate, and this includes on the front pages of the best papers that I've worked for, you know, the LA Times, the New York Times. It includes many times reporters writing about things that to anybody who's studied the issue and knows what the issues are, the reporter has no idea what they're writing about. They're just accurately quoting what they're told. This is one of the reasons I'm glad to see organizations like Al Jazeera come along, because the news business has become sclerotic, partly through its own fault and partly because of years of intimidation that the news media don't talk about, but years of intimidation by various forces, both commercial and political, of reporters who don't practice stenography.
Well, you know, the other angle here, I mean, you write, David, about government contractors. And, you know, at a time when sequestration is coming again in October, and it's going to hit everything from, you know, school lunches, meals on wheels, you name it, government contractors are seeing their profits explode. And yeah. You found a really good piece in the Washington Times.
Yes, and not a place that a lot of people would normally think of for being really good, but they did a very good job on this, and there have been some others since then. I mean, to paraphrase Mel Brooks, it's good to be a contractor. Government contractors cost taxpayers, on average, twice as much for an employee as a civil servant. This has been thoroughly documented by Professor Paul Light at New York University from the official public record. It is an inefficient means. It results in all sorts of craziness. Now, the Obama administration came in with all of the claims they made of transparency, and they put up a website with every government contract there. I wrote a column for Tax Notes magazine, part of Tax Analysts, pointing out that if you add up all the IRS contracts in this site for the last, I think it's 10 years, they come to something like almost $6 trillion. Wow. That would be far more than the federal government spends in a year. Because the website is so badly designed. Who's it run by? A contractor. Who runs the IRS website? A contractor that is a tax-exempt company in Bermuda.
Wow.
This is a real problem. I mean, basically, these big corporations have figured out that it's easier to mine the public treasury than to go out and sell a useful product in a competitive market. And the way they mine the treasury is they persuade politicians that business will be more efficient. We can lower costs and save money. No, we can't. That's not what's happened. The record is the exact opposite. And we now have a military that has gone to lowest bid contracting. Instead of these very expensive, hardened security tools that they had so that, you know, computer chips and things were better, you know, we're now buying computer chips made in China. And then expecting our military to depend on them. Really? Doesn't strike me as a very smart strategy.
Well, and again, to give kudos to the Washington Times, they reviewed financial disclosure records and found that last year, 59 major publicly traded government contractors made $36 billion in profits, nearly entirely from taxpayers, up from $35 billion in 2011. And then also, giving kudos to the Washington Post, they have a good story about the NSA's, or the intelligence, I should say, black budget. $52.6 billion in fiscal 2013.
Yes, now that comes from Edward Snowden, who has leaked these documents and who the U.S. administration regards as a very highly dangerous criminal. He certainly broke the law, but I think he's also proved to be something of a hero to the public, because but for him, we wouldn't know the government has the capacity, doesn't mean it is, but has the capacity to listen in on any phone call you make. And apparently contractors like Mr. Snowden can, could, when he was working for a contractor, could do so. We really have a federal government that for several decades now has been remarkably unaccountable to the public. We're talking about attacks in Syria. We've had these two long wars in the Middle East, and yet our Congress has, which under our Constitution, Congress decides if we go to war. Our Congress last voted articles of war in 1941, and none of the wars we've been involved in since have been constitutionally authorized, at least in my view, my reading of the Constitution. The same thing with all of this spying, despite the fact that we have a Bill of Rights and we have the notion that you will be secure in your person's papers and property. We have a government that's built up this enormous capacity, done it with outside contractors, and clearly lied through its teeth to us again and again and again about what it was doing and the capacities that it has.
And the $52.6 billion black budget applies to 16 spy agencies with over 107,000 employees. This is a very long story, so you definitely want to check this out. We'll put a link on our website, yourcallradio.org. That is David K. Johnston. He's a columnist at the Columbia Journalism Review. His latest book, The Fine Print, is now out in paperback. Katie Valentine is a climate reporter with Think Progress. We've got just about 5 minutes left. If you'd like to weigh in on coverage of these issues, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Katie, you know, the information is out there. I mean, the Washington Post has this great piece. David writes about this. The Washington Times wrote about government contractors. The local papers are doing an excellent job on sequestration and budget cuts, about how it's affecting the most vulnerable people, children, single moms, people with disabilities. So as a reporter, I mean, how do you connect the dots at a time when we keep being told the economy is bouncing back?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, news stories like the RIMS fire are really good opportunities for reporters to connect the dots for their audience. And obviously something like a wildfire, like I said, a wildfire that's close to Yosemite that people know about, you know, people do care about that. So I think that it is a really good opportunity to show, like, this is what sequestration means. This is what it means for people who have had to be evacuated in California, you know, for the firefighters who have lost their jobs. I think that, you know, opportunities like this, while they're tragic and while, you know, well, maybe, well, you know, wildfires are a natural part, but they're, you know, they can be tragic. While they're not, you know, fun to read about, I think they're a really good opportunity to connect these dots.
And the East Bay Express has a piece this week called Yosemite Fire Fueled by Budget Cuts, and looks at how Tuolumne Valley is being affected by this. Let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George. Welcome to the show. Hi, George.
Can you hear us?
Hi, yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I think David did a setup for this question, and I wanted to see if maybe we could articulate the question, which is simply that there must be a sizable lobby dedicated to gaining contracts, the ones that you were just describing, for various offshore contractors and others. How much of the noise that we hear about the government being too big, the government being swollen, we've got to cut down on government, bureaus, et cetera, how much is coming from that lobby?
David, have you looked into this?
Well, yes, and it doesn't come directly from the contractors. I mean, Lockheed or Booz Allen Hamilton is not going to go out and make that argument because it could redound back to them. But the people who are pushing this are things like the Heritage Foundation, Cato, which many people don't know is actually, even though it's a nonprofit, owned in large part by the Koch brothers as a very unusual financial structure. They're out making this argument all the time and arguing that we should have the private sector doing this work. What you'll hear the big contractors argue is that the private sector can be more efficient and will save taxpayers money. Unfortunately, the public record is pretty well developed at this point, and overall, it's just not true. And the places where it is true, it's because they simply replace people like janitors, is probably the best classic example, who had a living wage and benefits with people who work for a minimum wage with no benefits, no sick leave, no anything. So there clearly is a very big lobby for this. And, of course, it is become a mantra of the conservative Republicans that public employees bad. I mean, look at all the coverage in Wisconsin where you had public officials and a number of other folks calling school teachers thugs. Thugs, school teachers. Nurses called thugs. So there's a clear bias here against public employment in favor of contractors, even though the record there is one of higher costs and often not such good results.
Well, thank you for the email, George. Maybe we'll do a show about contractors in the future. We got an email from Henry about Al Jazeera America. He says, I have Comcast, but when I tried to check out Al Jazeera America, I got a message that I was not authorized. I called Comcast and spent ages on hold, only to be told that I would need to upgrade my cable plan for another $17 a month. I'd watch it occasionally if I could get it, but it's not worth that much to me. David, you write about this. You know, when I had television, I also called Comcast and said, can I please get the channels I want? You can have the shopping channel or something in exchange. And of course, they said no. But why does this happen?
Well, understand that the cable companies pay these channels. And in your monthly cable bill, the biggest single thing you're paying for is ESPN. The basic ESPN channel alone gets over $4 a month. I never watch sports, never, literally never, and I'm spending altogether, I calculate, about $6 a month on my cable bill just for these channels I don't watch. Then they take channels, if they don't want to put something on the air, they put it into a tier or a marketing package that'll jack up the price. Al Jazeera would probably be perfectly happy to get a penny a customer a month across the country. Now, Time Warner immediately shut off Current when Al Gore and his buddy Hyatt owned it, and they announced the sale to Al Jazeera. But I suspect the reasons there are partly not just anti-Muslim bias, but competitive problems. CNN International is very lucrative. It's watched all over the world. Al Jazeera is a serious economic threat to CNN. And so by dropping the channel, they, of course, strengthened their commercial position.
Hmm. Well, we'll follow this and see what happens. Bob in Watsonville just called in to give kudos to the local paper, the San Juan Star, for covering fracking in San Benito County, especially reporters Darlene Boyd and John Freeman. Thanks for that, Bob. And I just wanted to ask you before we end, I watched this documentary this week called We Are Not Broke, about how corporations dodge billions of dollars in income. And David, you cover this so closely. I hear...
And I'm in that documentary.
Yes, you are. I hear often when, like, NPR had this really interesting story this week about kids with disabilities and how important parks are for these kids because they're able to interact with other kids and they just, you know, feel like they're outside and they're happy. But cities can't afford these parks. And a lot of the mayors were quoted in the story saying we're broke. What should a reporter do when a politician says we're broke?
Well, the point, of course, of we're not broke is not that city governments aren't broke. We've set up mechanisms that have left many of them, you know, in desperate need for money. It's that as a society, we're not broke. The problem we have is that it has been the subtle policies of our government that take from the many to give to the few. And that's what my books, my trilogy, A Perfectly Legal Free Lunch, and The Fine Print document, along with a lot of other stuff I've written. I think what reporters should do is ask questions about, well, where are you spending money? If crime in your city is down 30%, is the police department been shrunk 30% over the years? If crime is down 30%, is the county jail and the city lockup got fewer people in it? Because what you'll generally find is, no, the number of people locked up remains consistent because there's a budget there, and sheriffs and police chiefs don't want to lose any of that budget. It's to begin asking questions about how your local government is spending its resources.
David K. Johnston is a columnist at the Columbia Journalism Review. The Fine Print is now out in paperback. And Katie Valentine is a climate reporter with Think Progress. Thank you for joining us. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What will it take to shift power back to the people? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Hedrick Smith about his book, Who Stole the American Dream? He says the last four decades of corporate and political power have led to the dismantling of the American dream. With politicians ignoring public opinion and the middle class shrinking, where do we go from here? And what does the dream mean to you? It's Your Call with Matt Martin and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.